The Brain Science Podcast is part of sciencepodcasters.org, the website where you can find high-quality science podcasts from a wide variety of fields. Welcome to the Brain Science Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell, and this is episode 88. Today's episode is an interview with Dr. Bruce Hood, whose latest book is entitled The Self Illusion: How the Social Brain Creates Identity. Before I get into the interview, I want to make one brief announcement. I will be attending the 2012 meeting of the American Academy of Family Physicians, which is being held in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, from October 16th through the 20th. When I travel, I like to look for opportunities to meet listeners. So if you're going to be in Philadelphia around October 16th, be sure to listen all the way to the end of this episode for more information. As always, I want to mention that detailed show notes and free episode transcripts are available for every episode of the Brain Science Podcast at brainsciencepodcast.com. And you can send me feedback at docartemis@gmail.com. As I mentioned, my guest today is Dr. Bruce Hood, and we'll be talking about his latest book, The Self Illusion, which is available from our sponsor, audible.com, under its UK title, The Self Illusion: Why There Is No You Inside Your Head. It's actually narrated by Bruce Hood himself. If you aren't already a member of audible.com, you can get this as a free audio download by going to audiblepodcast.com/brainscience. You can also get lots of the other books that have been featured on the Brain Science Podcast. So, Bruce, I want to welcome you to the Brain Science Podcast.
Hi there.
I guess it's been a couple of years since we met at TAM, and even longer than that since you were on my Books and Ideas podcast. So, for the sake of my new listeners, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a professor of developmental psychology, which means I basically study children, and my perspective is very much guided by neuroscience. So, whilst I don't do any direct brain measurement work anymore with children, I used to do that a long time ago, I try to understand the significant changes in children's thoughts and behaviors in terms of what could be possibly the neuroscience for that. I have a particular interest. My first book, by the way, was on irrational thinking in its natural state in children and how this might underpin adult supernatural beliefs. More recently, I've started to think about the nature of identity and the nature of self and how we start to construct that through the developmental process and the interaction of our biology with our environments. So that's what I'm currently interested in.
And so that is what led to your latest book.
That's right. Yeah, The Self Illusion: Why There's No You Inside Your Head, or in the American title, I think, is How the Social Brain Creates Identity.
The British title is Why There's No You Inside Your Head.
Yeah, that's right. They're always a little bit more quirky sometimes, the British, when they come up with titles. Certainly my publisher here.
I think both titles work, although it does get confusing if you look on Amazon. And I think I wrote to you when your book first came out because I thought it was two different books. And I was like, which one should I get?
Yeah, publishers are terrible at doing that. They sometimes reissue the book under a different title, which can be a pain. So that happened with my first book, Supersense. It came out in hardback in the US as Supersense, and then it came out as The Science of Superstition as a paperback. So I think that was a bit naughty because it suggests it's a completely different book.
I'm glad you mentioned that because it was still called Supersense when I originally interviewed you. Any new listeners looking for it now will have to look for, what was the new title?
The Science of Superstition.
This idea of self-illusion, I guess the first thing I would like for you to talk about is what you do and do not mean by this.
Yeah. So the word illusion to some people means there's nothing there. And that's not what I mean. An illusion is an experience which is not what it seems. That's the proper definition of illusion. And the experience of the self, I think, is very familiar to everyone. And that is a sense of conscious awareness of identity, personal history. And that's something that we all experience. But the notion that we are the integrated, coherent individuals that the self experience is, that's what I'm calling into question.
I like the fact that you talked about each of us has a matrix. Would you expand on that for just a second?
Okay. Well, the Matrix is the 1999 science fiction blockbuster the human race have been enslaved by these evil computers or machines, which are harvesting all their biochemical, electrical energy from their brains to sort of satisfy their energy needs. But the way they do this is they keep the humans enslaved in a state of suspended animation and then feed directly into their brains a simulation program called the Matrix, which is a simulation of the real world, so that the enslaved humans never realize what their true state of mind is. I made the argument that in many ways, all of our experience is to some extent a simulation of reality because we don't have any direct contact with reality. All senses are processed and transmitted and transduced into electrical impulses that then propagate across the neural nets of our brains, which become the basis of the representations of the external world or the representations. So the mind is constantly reconstructing representations that stand in reference to the external world. And often there's a whole bunch of tricks that are going on. There's filling in missing information or creating experiences which are not exactly matched to reality. So in that sense, we are simulating an external world.
Why should we want to understand this? Why should we care?
It's interesting because it demonstrates how the brain has evolved to take shortcuts and process information, especially to enable us to have a particular type of experience. I mean, the best example, I think, is from vision. Most people think vision, when they look around their world, they see it as very detailed, rich, coherent, when in fact, the visual world is fragmented. It's very piecemeal. You're completely colorblind, the periphery of your vision. It's very blurred. And yet, the experience you have is one of great detail. And I make the point that even every time you move your eyes, the visual world disappears. You're effectively blind. And there's a good reason for that. Because if you were to move your eyes and be visually aware when you're moving your eyes, the world would be smeared and blurred all the time. So the brain compensates for that by basically blanking out that part of the image. So there's an adaptation, a specific mechanism, which is solving a particular problem, an engineering problem, if you like, or an optical problem. And that's interesting to know. It shows you the way the brain has created this experience for you to provide the best optimal way of moving around and processing the world.
One of the things I appreciated about your book was that you brought out that the better that we understand what our brain's kind of up to, it sort of makes sense of some of the daily inconsistencies that we see in our own behavior and in the behavior of people around us.
Yes, absolutely. I think that we have an idealized notion of ourselves. Well, most of us do. Not everyone does. I mean, if people are severely depressed, for example, they may have a distorted view. Some often argue, in fact, their view is actually more accurate than the rest of us. The rest of us are eternal optimists living in a deluded sense of positivism. But yes, we have this notion of what we think we are, and we try to live a life which, you know, coincides with that. But in doing so, we often reframe or reinterpret our behaviors or thoughts in a way which is consistent with that idealized notion of who we are. So this is the phenomenon of cognitive dissonance. This is where we reframe and reinterpret events and outcomes and behaviors to fit with what we think is the way we are. And I think that if you understand people as being complicated multitudes of competing drives and impulses, then it makes sense of what seems erratic behavior, because we have these expectancies from other people. And when they seem to do something which seems so out of character, we're confused by that. But then we fail to realize that often our expectations for others doesn't actually match with what they're really like. And so that's clearly obvious in the situation of celebrities who go off the rails. It turns out their dark sides or inner selves are very different to what their public personas are.
And I hope one of the things we can come away with from this is to realize that we all have those, and maybe we won't be throwing so many stones at people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think that it's very easy to spot the frailties in other people, but we very often fail to miss the big ones in our own personalities. And of course, it's been picked up in various kind of quotes and readings from the Bible about, you know, spotting the plank in someone else's eye. I can't remember what the exact quote is, but it's basically we tend to sort of easily see other people's mistakes and not see our own.
Obviously, this idea that the brain is creating this whole idea of who we are and what the world around us is like is not new. In fact, a couple of guests that I've had that come to mind are Chris Frith and Thomas Metzinger. Especially Thomas is really into this idea. What would you say is new that you bring to the table on this topic?
Well, for me, it's the really important mechanism is development. You're right, absolutely. The notion of the self has been under question for thousands of years, and the neuroscience is certainly supporting this idea. You know, if you see the brain damaged, then the personality is changed. Just the way that the brain is a multitude of separate processing subsystems that culminate together to create a unified experience. Again, it's testimony to the idea that we are a multitude. But for me, the interesting new perspective is the emergence of self in the growing child. So I'm very interested in the way the child starts to become socialized. So I don't believe that children are blank slates. Even though I've emphasized in this book the importance of the social environment, I'm not for one moment suggesting that it's all entirely to do with everyone around us. But I would argue that the predispositions that we're born with, which are part of our genetic inheritance, our temperaments, they respond and resonate with the environments in which we're raised. So it's this combination of the biology and the environment, I think, which works together to create the complexity in the emerging self. And there's a real shift in this sense of identity in children. So below about 2 years of age, few of us have any memory of identity or personal memories for that matter. This is a common phenomenon known as infantile amnesia. And it used to be thought that this was somehow an immaturity of the brain to store memories. But we know that's not the case. We know that much younger babies can store memories for quite considerable periods of time, but they don't have a sense of self-identity. And I think that's what's going on. I think without a sense of who you are as a character, then it's very difficult to integrate information into meaningful memories that become stored as your personal identity. Even as the child is developing, their emerging sense of self is changing quite radically. So initially, in very general terms, the child is fairly egocentric, if you like. So they don't really fully appreciate that others have different mental states or different opinions or different perspectives. But as they reach their sort of second to third birthday, they start to shift to a growing awareness that they're surrounded by others who have different opinions and expectations. So they're starting to become more influenced by how they are perceived. They get very concerned about status. They start to show embarrassment for the first time. This is starting to appear in, you know, toddlers. And so there's a growing concern about what others think about us. And I think that's one of the big preoccupations of humans is how we see ourselves in relation to others. And I think that's part of the construction of the image of self.
I want to talk some more about that aspect of the topic in just a minute. But in terms of what's happening when babies are really small, you said they're not blank slates and they're also not sponges, right?
Yeah.
They have to interact with their world.
That's right. And that's been a shift in our perspective in child and infant development in the past 20 years. Prior to that, the dominant theoretical perspective was by Jean Piaget, who argued that children are effectively little scientists born with brains which are designed to seek out structure and order in the world and to test out ideas. And that is true to some extent, but what I think he neglects in his theory, and he's often been criticized for this, is he doesn't take into consideration the scaffolding role of elders and parents with children. So babies are just wired to pay attention to other people. The most interesting thing to a young baby is another person. And so they're fascinated by watching other people, and they spontaneously mimic and imitate and copy. So I think there's a combination of mechanisms. There's a drive to understand the world, but there's also a drive to interact with others and pay attention to them. So this is shifting our perspective on the mechanisms by which children are actually cognitively developing. It seems to be more to do with an interplay between the child and the adult and the environment.
Language acquisition, I suppose, is one thing that's been studied as much as anything else. Does that have any important clues for us for what's going on in terms of these new ways of looking at things?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So there's language perception, which is the ability to sort of segment a speech signal into different sort of segments of sounds and words and phonemes. And that's a fairly automatic process. So we don't actually teach our children to speak. Okay, that's just something which is wired into the brain. This is a point that Chomsky and Pinker and others have made. However, it's not simply automatic. It does require scaffolding. So naming, for example, we know that children pay a lot of attention to the way that adults label things. So you can facilitate language acquisition by interacting in a meaningful way with the child. So they are noting what other people are doing when they're hearing languages.
One of the things I appreciated in the book was you mentioned that babies are wired, so to speak, to learn from interaction with people, not technology.
That's right, yeah. They're especially sensitive to synchrony. We know this from a variety of studies, but basically people who have atypical interactions, if they have desynchronized activity with their babies, this is highly stressful to infants. A lot of the early interaction is all to do with synchrony, even something as simple as feeding. When they're being breastfed or being fed, there's almost a coordinated sequence of interaction, and the child is very sensitive to the synchronization. And that's something that stays with us throughout our development. You know, we prefer people to be in synchrony with us, and we find people who act incongruously or out of synchrony, we find that very difficult to interact with them. So just a simple conversation is really a coordinated synchrony of nonverbal communication as well as the exchange of words and sentences. A lot of this is often unconscious, which is one of the reasons that we prefer people who kind of mimic and imitate us, even though we're not aware that they're doing it.
Do you give parents any particular advice based on what you know about what's happening in little kids' brains as they're developing?
Actually, no. I tend to avoid doing that, although I'm always asked about how best to facilitate development. I've always been very wary and skeptical of people who dish out edicts about what's the best way to raise your child. I'm very critical of those professionals who are basically selling, I think, false dreams about housing and this idea that you can supercharge a child's learning by, you know, exposing them to Mozart tapes or flashcards or stuff like that. I think that whole industry is just dependent on people's anxieties that their child is going to end up somehow impoverished. But the truth of the matter is that a typical world in a westernized child is full of rich information, so they can't really be hothoused in any way. I do think that there is some concern about a trend to sort of stick children in front of televisions or let them watch DVDs. I mean, that, if anything, seems to suggest that's actually detrimental. But the normal interaction that you see in most households is full of rich information, so you don't need to worry too much about it. Kids will be just fine.
But from what you told me, I get the feeling that even something as simple as smiling at your baby when he smiles at you is beneficial to the baby.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Several years ago, I interviewed this scientist named Marianne Wolf, who studies reading in the brain, and she said that you can't make children learn how to read any sooner than they're going to learn how to read, which is another one of those myths. She actually said the big thing that they get is if they're sitting on your lap and you're reading, it's as much about that social interaction with you as it is the reading.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's when it goes in the opposite direction, when it's extreme. So people, for example, who are depressed, mothers are depressed, if you look at their interactions, they're totally desynchronized to their children. They're either not responding or they're overly responding in a way which is equally aversive to the child. But actually, you just reminded me about, you know, reading to your child. That is something actually probably I would suggest that people do, because there's some research to show that when you talk to children, they're a bit older now, this is like 2-3 years of age, as you talk to them, if you talk to them about their day, you can enhance their capability to remember much earlier events. And part of the argument is that by providing the scaffolding of a narrative, it's easier for the child to link all this information together. And so there have been studies of the way that parents interact with their children, or mothers in particular, interact with their children in the East versus the West. And in Eastern cultures, they typically will talk about the child integrated into the day, as it were, you know, what they've done. Whereas in the West, it's much more child-focused, just talking about it from the child's perspective. So there are different ways, different cultures that parents interact with their children. And this appears to influence the sort of retention of memory. So you find better memory in the Eastern children at an earlier age than the West. And part of the explanation is based on the way they interact with them.
Things you said in the book was, and I think I wrote this quote down from page 35, we often forget that we are the only animals on this planet that retain skills and knowledge that we pass on to our offspring. I guess some people might argue with that.
Yeah, I suspect some of the tool-making chimps would be the argument, but we do create culture and literature and information. Obviously, prior to writing, that was done by word of mouth, but we do it in a way which I think far excels any other animal's capability to transfer information. I think their flexibility of their behaviors is fairly rigid in comparison to what we do spontaneously.
I talked about smiling at the baby a minute ago. Is there research that shows that smiling's linked to social learning or supports it in some way?
Yeah. Well, people smile more often when there are other people around. Being observed, people smile. So it's clearly signaling to others an emotional state. It's wired in from the start. Blind babies smile, but they lose that if they're not reinforced by interaction. So if you jiggle a blind baby, they will continue to keep smiling. But if they don't get that interaction, then that smiling disappears after about 3 to 4 months. It's a mechanism which is wired in. It becomes part of the repertoire power of our behaviors, but we do it effectively to interact with others. Likewise, contagious emotions such as yawning, laughing, these again are all mechanisms which are dependent on social interaction. There's some interesting studies suggesting that they're impaired in children with autism, so they don't have the contagious yawning that you see. It's just one of these examples. We tend to use these expressions as a form of signaling to others.
And you mentioned autism. That kind of illustrates the importance of social interaction for learning, because not being able to do that is really a severe disability.
Yes. I mean, I think there are different, obviously, varying degrees of autism, and I suspect there's more than one pathway to autism. But yes, one of the characteristics or one of the triad features of autism is impaired social interaction. And it was thought that they weren't capable of reading other people's, for example, eye gaze. I don't think that's the issue. I think it's that they find it aversive. That's what our work suggests, is that it's not they can't do it, it's just they don't like doing it, because I think they find it very confrontational. So they try to avoid it.
When it comes to social interaction, all babies are not the same. Could you talk a little bit about Jerome Kagan's work and how that fits in here?
Yeah, so Jerome Kagan's an ex-colleague of mine at Harvard, and Jerome was very interested in reactivity, which is just a kind of another way of talking about the limbic system, which is part of the brain which controls what we call arousal, which is our reactivity to stimulation. And there's a spectrum of response. So some babies are a little bit more laid back, and some of them are very hypersensitive to stimulation, but it's the extent to which they can habituate back down to a normative level. Kagan has shown, well, he's shown a number of things. First of all, these temperaments, as he called them, are fairly stable. So you can predict on the basis of how an infant responds to sensory stimulation in the first 4 months, what they're going to be like at 4 years and at 14 years, as it were. He thinks that these temperaments are really the mechanisms which drive our social interactions and attachments. Children are highly reactive, will form these difficult relationships with their parents, whereas those who are a bit more laid back are much more boisterous, much more open, extroverted type of individuals. Yeah, he thinks these are stable personality traits.
And fortunately, most parents are able to adapt to the variability between their children.
That's right. Anyone who has any doubts about the heritability of personality or the difference between individuals just needs to have children. And it shows quite clearly that they do come into the world with different types of predispositions. But that doesn't mean that there isn't any interaction. And that's the point I was trying to make with the self-evolution, is that we mold ourselves to the individual and to the environments that we're raised in.
The example in the book of the Romanian orphanages, what lesson should we take away from that?
Yes, well, that's an example of extreme deprivation. So this was the studies of the children who were saved. This is when Ceausescu's regime collapsed. It turned out that he'd been forcing his population to have as many children as possible, and basically mothers couldn't look after them, so they were dumping them in these orphanages. Some of these children clearly had brain damage, but not all of them. But in all the instances, they were kept in really poor conditions. So you had 50 children being looked after by one negligent guard. And I mean, they were fed and they were watered down, but they were really didn't have any social interaction. So when these children were rescued, researchers in the US and Canada and the UK followed up a whole bunch of them to see how they progressed. The basic finding was that if the children were younger than 6 months when they were adopted, then their trajectory was absolutely normal. They were indistinguishable from a control group. But children who were older than 6 months, the longer they had been in care in the Romanian orphanages, the more damaged they were. This was controlled for in terms of their body weight, so we know it wasn't entirely to do with malnutrition. There was something else going on, and the argument was that it was the lack of normal social interaction which had created these impairments. Now, these children are now about 20 years of age, and they've been followed up periodically. And the consistent finding is that they still have impaired social interaction. They're social deviant. A lot of them have ADHD, hyperactivity. And so there seems to be this legacy of the amount of time they spend as children. No matter how good the adopted family was, how good the nurturing environment was, it couldn't overcome this. So it suggests this might be what we call in the field an example of plasticity of a sensitive period. And sensitive period phenomenon, or critical period phenomenon, it's sometimes called, is this idea that there is an imperative to get certain environmental experiences at the right time. And if you don't get them, then this causes permanent impairment. Now, we kind of knew this already from the work by Harry Harlow in the 1960s, because Harlow had done the work raising rhesus monkeys in isolation. And by coincidence, he also found that the critical period appeared to be 6 months. If you raise them in isolation longer than that, then you had permanent damage. So it might be a coincidence, but it appears that both humans and rhesus macaques need to have this early interaction, and it's quite important.
The bottom line is that the brains of babies and actually people of all ages thrive on social interaction. But as far as parents go, as long as you're having, you know, a normal environment, that's going to take care of itself, right? It's not something you have to do on purpose because it's just part of being human.
Absolutely. It's in our natural repertoire. The way that we normally respond to infants, the fact that we look at them and interact with them and, you know, just engage with them, that is sufficient. You don't need to worry about trying to sort of hothouse it, as I say, or work out a regime of interaction. Just the simple way that most people will just naturally interact with a baby is sufficient and they'll be fine.
Let's talk a little bit about the consequence of the fact that our brains are so social. That means that we care an awful lot about what other people think.
Absolutely. I think that one of the worst things you can do to anyone is to socially isolate them or ostracize them. And there's a bunch of work. Kit Williams is a psychologist who's looked at this. Interestingly enough, he came across this phenomenon when he was in a park one day and there were these guys playing frisbee and they threw the frisbee to him or it landed near him and he picked it up and spontaneously disengaged and throwing it to them. And then for some reason, they just returned to just playing with themselves and he felt this sudden pain of rejection. And so from this common experience, he developed a whole paradigm of ostracism to see what happens to people when they've been rejected. And it turns out it activates the pain centers of the brain. There's a whole lot of negative emotions which go on when we're left by ourselves. So we're very sensitive to being excluded. It's a really important component of human interaction to be included. And so we'll do anything to avoid being excluded to the extent that we'll be obsequious and almost try and bend over backwards, as we say, try and be included in group activities. But that's the case for most of us. I do accept that there are some individuals who just don't do that. But for the majority of humans, it's really important to be a member of a group.
You had a unique take on the mirror test in your discussion of it in the book that sort of relates to this. Would you talk about what people normally think the mirror test means and possible alternative?
Yeah. So the mirror test or the Rouge test was originally developed by Gordon Gallup. And it was based on this idea. Actually, Charles Darwin first noted that, I think it was an orangutan in London Zoo, didn't appear to notice or didn't appear to recognize himself in his reflection. And so Gordon Gallup developed this technique where to test for self-recognition, he would put a small smudge of rouge makeup on the forehead of the animal and then present them to a mirror. And if the animal understood that the reflection was themselves, then they would try and remove it. But he found that, in fact, most animals behaved as if the reflection was another different animal, as it were. So the mirror test has been used as a measure of self-recognition. And typically, infants won't remove the smudge before about 18 months. So the argument is they don't have any sense of self before then. But I think that's overinterpretation of the finding. I think it's probably more likely that mirror recognition is actually more a measure of self-awareness of others, how you look towards others. And so this work by Philip Rochat is another developmental psychologist who's demonstrated that, you know, you can find children much older than 2 years in different cultures fail the mirror test, but then they clearly know what their reflection is. It can't be the case that they don't have a self-identity. Rather, he thinks that the better, more parsimonious explanation is that they simply don't know what the experimenter wants from them. Why has he put this sort of mark on their forehead? So they don't know whether to remove it or leave it. So it's not that they don't recognize themselves. They just don't know what to do in those circumstances. So I think the mirror test is not so much a measure of self-recognition, but awareness of other people's attention.
In your book, you mentioned the idea of the core self and that you consider that an illusion. I wasn't really sure what definition of core self you had in mind when you debunked it. Do you mind talking about that for a second?
Well, if you ask people, tell me about yourself, or tell me what you think yourself is, for most people, they generally fit with the characterization that William James talked about, which is the distinction between an I and a me. So the I is the conscious awareness of being in the present moment and having the authorship of actions, the notion that you're in control, you've got free will, that everything is coherent and integrated. That's the in the current moment. And then the notion of me is the personal identity, which is who you are based on all your past information and experiences. And this is the story of who you are. But both the I and the me, I think, are constructed. Certainly that we know that our memories are always constructed, reinterpreted, reframed. So information is reformatted to fit with a characterization. And the sense of I and having free will is also to some extent constructed or questionable, at least. Work on conscious control, for example, has shown that very often a lot of the mechanisms or actual factors which are determining our choices we're not aware of. And yet we feel that we are consciously making these decisions all the time. And I tend to think of consciousness as the output of a multitude of unconscious processes. I like Steve Pinker's version of it. He talks about it as being the spin doctor of experience. What he means by that is that there are a multitude of unconscious processes which eventually, when the checks and balances are done, end up producing thoughts or behaviors. And then we take ownership of those as being ourself, as being the one making the decision. So I think most people sort of have this notion of the I and the me. And I think there's another sense of the self, which people feel that they're occupying their body. I think Chris Frith also has this kind of characterization. It's the sense that we are inhabiting our bodies, that we are controlling our bodies. Our bodies are like machines or vessels, which we occupy. But then this kind of creates this distorted notion of what we call the homunculus, the little person inside a body. And the reason that that core self can't really be true is that it just creates a logical fallacy, because if there's a little person inside you, then who's inside their head and their head and so on and so forth. So you get into this infinite regress of always positing an internal entity. And that's why I don't think there is an internal core self. Rather, it must be the output of the multitude of processes.
That makes sense. You made an allusion to the issue of free will, which I don't think that we really are going to have time to talk about. I mentioned in the introduction that the Brain Science Podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, but most of the financial support for this podcast comes from listeners like you. I want to take a moment to thank all of you who have supported the show with donations over the last 5 years. If you are interested in helping support my work, just go to BrainSciencePodcast.com and look for the tab labeled Donations. It's right under the Brain Science Podcast logo at the top of the page. But don't forget, even if you can't afford to contribute money, you can help promote the show by sharing it with others. You mentioned in your book that you have a long-standing interest in the problems of people who have self-control issues, and that brings up the whole issue of willpower. Can you talk a little bit about the research in that area?
Yeah, so there's a lot of interest in willpower, and ego depletion is currently a topic of great interest. There's a basic finding that when you try to exert control through willpower in one realm, then you can get a rebound effect where you gorge yourself on food or things that you shouldn't do. And this is the notion of ego depletion. So Roy Baumeister is the psychologist who's done this work, but basically he's showing that if you put people in stressful situations where they're having to control their will, it could be a horror movie or a situation where they have to control their behavior. As soon as they go into out of that circumstance or out of that situation, and you present them with things which they normally would try to resist the temptation of, drink or cookies or stuff like that, then they rebound back and eat much more and drink much more. And so the argument is that in exerting willpower, you're depleting a reservoir of ability to control the world around you. And that's this notion of ego depletion. And it's been demonstrated over and over again. I think it's a really interesting finding. I'm interested in what are the mechanisms for control. And certainly, again, this comes back to developmental psychology, because we know that children have real problems with impulse control. And it's not so much that they don't know the rules. It's just that they lack that ability to regulate their behavior. Now, again, one of the neuroscience possibilities here is this is due to the lack of overall what we call executive function from the prefrontal cortex, which is the last part of the brain to mature. It doesn't reach maturation until, well, adult levels. So right up until adolescence and teenagers, one of the arguments is that they have impaired frontal lobe control. Now, I don't necessarily think that's true. I think there's a whole lot of other reasons why teenagers behave the way they do, which isn't necessarily to do with lack of inhibitory control. But I think it is interesting that we do have these regulatory systems which serve to try and suppress all these competing unconscious processes which are always trying to take over our behaviors and our thoughts. I think this is a really fascinating area. It remains to be seen whether Baumeister's notion of ego depletion actually stands the scrutiny, because it turns out that the effects seem to be dependent on what your expectations are. So it's not clear to me that it really is as he describes it. Nevertheless, it's still, you know, amazing body of work, which has got some very fascinating findings.
Yeah, and one of the things that it has going for it is that it seems intuitively true to anyone who's been in a stressful situation. Like, if you ever watch the things that people who work in the emergency room, which is what I do for a living, eat and drink, when I read in your book about, well, the results sort of depend on what you believe, I was wondering, well, I wonder if I didn't think this, I would do better on not drinking those Mountain Dews.
Yeah, like a lot of these things, I mean, they are context dependent. There are sort of expectations and what's considered normative behavior. So there's a multitude of factors, which, by the way, is what psychology is all about. When people get very frustrated with psychology, they say, oh, well, it all depends. Well, that just proves the point that we are the culmination of a vast interaction of different factors, and sometimes teasing them apart is really difficult. It's always difficult to draw very clear causal mechanisms when it comes to predicting human behavior. But I think we're making a lot of progress. So I think that it's not necessarily a depressing situation. There are still some true aspects of human behavior which we can readily anticipate.
I want to talk about the role of stories, but before we do, I think we need to talk just a little bit more about how people are more influenced by groups than they may think.
Well, the part of the book which deals with the effects of groups really harks back to some of the classic social psychology work from the 1960s and 70s. Some critics of the book have said, oh, you know, this is old stuff. Well, it may be old stuff, but that doesn't mean it's not important. And I think that any understanding of human behavior has to really try to get to grips with some of the classic demonstrations, the way that we are so compliant and obedient to other individuals, especially if we perceive they're in power. So this really stems from a work which was really post-war. People were interested in why people behaved the way they did, especially in Nazi Germany, why they did the things they did. Were they evil? What happened to their psychology that made them do the things they did? And this is, of course, work by Solomon Asch, who originally did some of the work on compliance. And then more famously, obviously, Stanley Milgram's work with getting people to administer lethal electric shocks. That original research from 50 years ago has stood up to scrutiny. It's been replicated and done again. And people generally will do things which they'd never dreamed they're capable of doing. So their self-story of them being morally upstanding and willing to sort of stand up against authoritarianism is not true. We do comply all the time, and we do this very readily and very easily. Now, you might say it's not done unconsciously, but people will always, again, try and reframe the situation to fit with their kind of characterization that they're normally a good person. Again, this comes back to this point. Daily, we're confronted with inconsistencies of what we think we're like, and so we just simply retell the story to make it seem as if we're not really to blame. But it is, again, the power of groups to comply, to not sort of stand out. And this, of course, does depend on individuals. Not everyone's the same. And there are some people who are much more compliant than others. And there are cultural differences as well. In the West, we value the individualistic person. But of course, that's frowned upon in collectivist societies, where anyone who stands out is perceived to be antisocial. So there are cultural effects on how we behave, but ultimately, whether we're individualistic or collectivist, we're still responding to what is the social group, which is the norm.
Does prejudice come into this story too? It's a sort of related point that you made about how, because of our tendency to group things and stereotypes begin early in our mind.
Yeah.
I think you said late in the book that prejudice may actually be the norm. That doesn't mean we should not try to be prejudiced, but if we realize that we all have a tendency to do it, instead of assuming that it means that the person's bad or evil. I mean, the scary thing about the work of people like Milgram and the guy that did the student experiment.
Oh, Zimbardo's.
The scary thing is that these people weren't evil.
That's right. It was called The Banality of Evil.
Hannah Arendt's work, yes.
That's it. Everyone has the potential to be manipulated into a way that they'd never dreamed they were capable of doing. So their story of self as being upstanding and morally just can be easily corrupted given the right circumstances. And this is, of course, what Zimbardo has been building his career. He calls it the Lucifer effect in his book. If you get the right context, we can all be, to some extent, manipulated to do things we'd never dreamed we were capable of doing. And it is quite remarkable.
But one positive point that you had in there was in, I don't remember which experiment it was, that showed that if there was at least one other person that went up against the group, that then it was more likely that other people would stand up. That's a good thing to know if you're in a situation. Maybe if you do speak up, someone else will.
Well, absolutely. So this is the original study by Solomon Asch. So just to remind listeners, this is a simple perceptual test where people had to judge length of lines. And what the participant didn't know, they're in a group of about 12 people. What they didn't know is the other 11 people are all part of the experiment, and they're the one that's actually under scrutiny. And so the experiment went along fine until at one point everyone starts giving the wrong answer. And they found that people invariably just go along with the group. Now, they don't suddenly become blind. They just prefer to go along with the group rather than standing out. But as soon as one other person in the group also dissented, then that was sufficient for the effect to disappear. So there's strength in numbers. And that's, again, something that oppressive regimes understand. That's why they try to suppress as quickly as possible anything, because as soon as you get a body of individuals acting collectively together, then they will stand up to oppression. So yes, these are interesting, very old experiments now, but I still think they're entirely relevant.
So we haven't talked much about memory, because I was kind of saving that to be part of the discussion of stories. Storytelling is a big part of who we are, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. We generate stories to make sense of our current experience. So I would argue that perception is a story to some extent, is that we integrate information into meaningful models of the world. That includes previous experiences, which we use to bring to bear upon our perception, but also just our memories are effectively stories. And so we edit out a lot of the information. We basically just take the highlights together, and then we put it together in a causally meaningful way. And so when you ask people to recount events, they're told effectively as causal stories. But of course, we know from ancient work now that memories are notoriously unreliable. You can distort them very easily. You can introduce all sorts of false memories simply by leading questions. This is the work of Elizabeth Loftus. So the sense that memory is somehow cast in stone is not true. Rather, memories are reconstructed events. So we're just basically piecing together all the bits of information to bring it together. And so our memory of who we think we are, what we've done in the past, again, as often includes a whole set of biases and inconsistencies, which again are because we have this characterization of who we think we are.
I happened to read your book very close in time to a book by a literary scholar, Jonathan Gottschall. It was called The Storytelling Animal.
Ah, right.
And if you haven't read that, it's a really good book. Your book and his, I think, dovetail nicely. Elizabeth Loftus, of course, her work shows this too, because the whole getting of the false memories is basically sticking them into the piece of the person's life story.
Yeah.
But in terms of our brains, it seems like that's the way we learn.
Well, absolutely, because all representations are associated patterns of activation. So they're networks of synchronized activity. So the idea is that when you get new information, you have to integrate it to the existing patterns of activation. So that's why false memories are indistinguishable from true memory. That's why people really do think they've had it, because they've become integrated. I think it's a general principle that stories are much easier to remember than unrelated facts. And the more overarching narrative that you have, the easier it is to sort of use that and transmit that to others. So I think that the author, I didn't catch his name, he's probably picking up on this really true part of what humans do, is that we tell each other stories. And we have done for a very, very long time. And that's because it's a very easy way to transmit information in a memorable way. If you just give people facts or they don't follow a narrative arc, then it's really difficult to do that. And so storytelling is a very optimal way of transferring information.
Yeah, his name is Jonathan Gottschall.
I'll look it out. Sounds interesting.
He happened to, while he was working on his book, have two small daughters who were 3 and 5, and he noticed how they were always in story mode.
Yes, that's right. Children do that all the time.
One of the things he was trying to figure out in writing his book was, what is storytelling for? And he was exploring the idea of whether it was a sort of a simulation. I think he called it the flight simulator model.
Right.
The reason I bring this up is because I know you've worked so many years with small children. At what age do you think, I don't have any children, so I'm at a disadvantage. My dogs don't really care about stories. They care about dog biscuits. At what age do small children start to think in that way? Is that when you start to get your autobiographical self at the same time as you can appreciate a story?
So children have certainly imagination, and they start to behave with pretense, we call it, and show imagination before their second birthday. But at that point, they're just using toys in imaginary ways. Some of them have imaginary friends, but that tends to disappear. But I think that the real ability to appreciate stories depends on acquiring a theory of mind, where you really have to understand someone has a mental state, which may be different from your own. If you think about it, all the storytelling requires us anticipating or understanding someone's perspective. And theory of mind is typically between 3 and 4 years of age. It can be a little bit sooner, but generally that seems to be a kind of threshold where children suddenly, like a switch goes on, and they suddenly understand that people can have different perspectives. So stories start to make a lot more sense. If you think about it, stories often have issues of deception or misunderstanding or people not being fully aware of the facts. And that's why you can anticipate what's going to happen next. when you have that capacity to put yourself in someone else's shoes. So you need to be able to have what we call perspective taking before you can really understand stories. And that's, again, probably around about 3 to 4 years of age.
I remember as a kid, I was always thinking about the story of Burr Rabbit. Don't throw me in the briar patch. I pondered on that for years as a kid. I think we definitely get lessons from the stories that were read as a small child. At least I know I did. Is there anything that we've left out that you'd like to talk about?
The book covers a lot of territory, and we didn't talk very much about the neuropsychology, the clinical conditions where people fractionate. That's fine. I think there are other people, there are other experts who work in that. What I've done in this book is I've tried to cover a vast territory in a way which is accessible. And I know some critics are not going to think that it's gone into enough depth, but the notion of self is such a complicated field that I don't think it could have been done to a greater depth. I think it's just really important to challenge a common assumption that we have this thing that is a self. And even though it might be an illusion, the point is it's really inescapable anyway. Talking about and dissecting it and demonstrating that we are a multitude doesn't get away from the fact that we need selves to interact. So I think that's an important point, that I can't imagine human interaction without the concept of self or the experience of a self. So in that sense, it doesn't really matter if it is an illusion. It's a very adaptive illusion, one that's very useful.
I find since I've been doing the Brain Science podcast that just watching people interact is much more fascinating to me than it was before, because it now seems obvious because I've been reading about it so much. For example, how much we communicate non-verbally. Oh, that is one subject we didn't say anything about. The internet.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that.
Do you think that's going to change how people develop their social brains?
I've got a whole chapter on the new technologies, and I really don't know. And I think that's a really exciting prospect to look out for. How is the sense of self going to change? We are interacting in a way which is unprecedented. The fact that you and I are having a conversation thousands of miles away in itself is strange. For example, the fact that your listeners will then probably be members of social networking sites and then exchanging their opinions and their ideas, telling people, often strangers, about themselves is really, really interesting. Twitter, I think, is one of the really fascinating new platforms. How is Twitter going to change our opinions? Well, I think it's creating new tensions. If you just look at Twitter, it is interesting the way that people behave on Twitter in a way that they wouldn't necessarily behave in real life. The way that our opinions suddenly are given importance by other strangers simply by either they retweet them or they give them a thumbs up. It's kind of interesting how we're seeking out validation all the time. The number of followers we might have, or the fact we might feel upset when someone starts to unfollow us or block us. So I think that the internet is an exciting new innovation in terms of social interactions. I really do not know how it's going to develop and how it's going to change us. Like most new technologies, it's probably not going to make a great difference to the way that we are as a species. But who knows? It's uncharted territory. So I'm going to keep an eye on it. I certainly notice myself behaving differently on social network sites, and often in a way I would rather not have done. I've called it socialization on steroids, because it's the capacity to communicate with thousands of people instantaneously, often without the ability to kind of think carefully what you're saying, because very often it's in response to somebody else's message or something like that. People react far too quickly, probably. I think that's going to be an interesting new development. Maybe it might take another generation for them to become perfectly acquainted with it, but at the moment there's still some teething problems as people try to adapt to this very fast and rapid form of social interaction.
Yeah, but I think it does show the importance of parents, though, when their kids are at least really little. I mean, if they get the basic ability to interact socially when they're small, I don't think they're going to lose that just because they learn how to text.
There's been some really stupid claims about the role of the internet causing autism, which is just simply unscientific. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. Autism is a biological condition. It's not to do with a lack of social interaction through computer games. Yes, I entirely agree. I think that a balanced upbringing will include social interaction. You know, we have, for as far back as we can measure, been a social animal, and we are one of the most social animals that have ever existed. And so we require that. And as I said in the book, it seems to be a very important factor in shaping who we are. We basically develop to become members of a social group, to become integrated, and that's really important. So if anything, I think these technologies might actually be beneficial, especially as we increasingly getting into situations where the population is now so massive. Interacting is changing. You know, our ability to live together is changing. So in many ways, seeking out others with the same opinions or same interests that's becoming much easier now with the technologies. As yet, I don't know what's going to happen. It'd be interesting. But we shouldn't immediately assume it's all going to be doom and gloom.
Yeah, not like Socrates, according to Plato, claiming that reading would be bad for your brain.
Yeah, reading would be bad for the masses. Yeah, they say the same thing about the printing press, the telephone, of course, television.
Yeah. Bruce, before we close, do you have any advice for students who are interested in neuroscience or even developmental psychology?
Well, I think for me, I've always said that emotion is really important. So I think that if you're going to pursue something like that, you got to ask yourself, does this excite you? And once you have an emotional connection with a topic, it becomes all the more easier to pursue it. I think that people should look for those aspects of neuroscience. It doesn't have to be behavioral. It could be any aspect of it. Indeed, it could be any area of endeavor. If you feel passionately about something, then that'll carry you a lot of the way. So if you enjoy it and it really makes you feel good about stuff, then yeah, pursue it.
That sounds like good advice. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close?
No, I think that's fine, Ginger. It's been a good interview.
I want to thank Dr. Bruce Hood for taking the time to talk with me about his new book, The Self Illusion, How the Social Brain Creates Identity. It's also available under its UK title, The Self-Illusion, Why There Is No You Inside Your Head, and this version is available from our sponsor at audible.com. Before I review a few key ideas, I want to mention that this is a great book for audiences of all levels. If you are new to the Brain Science Podcast, you will find that Dr. Hood refers to many of the books and guests who have appeared on the show in the last 5 years. So this is a great place to start your reading. But even if you're very familiar with the field, I think that Dr. Hood brings a unique perspective to the topic, and this could generate some new ideas for you. Thus, I highly recommend The Self-Illusion to everyone. Now I want to spend a few minutes reviewing the key ideas of today's episode. This is something I don't always do, but I've been getting a lot of requests to make it a regular feature. First of all, I want to remind everyone that the English word illusion means not that something doesn't exist, but that it's not what it seems. Dr. Hood said that what he is challenging is the notion that we are the integrated, coherent individuals that we usually experience as self. He uses the analogy of the movie The Matrix to capture the idea that our brain creates the world that we experience, and it also creates our experience of self. We talked very briefly about the concept of cognitive dissonance, which is actually a reflection of our brain's ongoing efforts to construct a unified story of who we are. If you're interested in learning more about cognitive dissonance, I refer you back to the interview I did with Carol Tavris. This is Books and Ideas, episode 43, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. The key idea is that everyone is made up of competing drives and impulses, mostly unconscious. So inconsistent behavior is not a mystery. As Bruce pointed out, it's always easier to see the frailties of others than it is to see our own. As far as the brain's role in creating the world as we experience it, this is a topic that we have also talked about with other guests, including Chris Frith and Thomas Metzinger. I will have links to their interviews in the show notes. So since this is a relatively familiar topic, I asked Dr. Hood what was the new thing that his book is bringing to the discussion. And he said that it is his emphasis on the role of development as a really important mechanism. He's very interested in how the sense of self emerges during childhood, which leads to his focus on the social environment. While children are not born blank slates, they are deeply influenced by their environment. And because humans are extremely social animals, the most important thing in the baby's environment is the people around it. We also talked about how developmental psychologists now appreciate that babies come wired to pay attention to other people, and they are driven to interact with their environments. One aspect of the importance of interaction that he mentioned was the importance of timing. The example he gave that really sticks in my mind was when he was talking about the fact that blind babies smile, but if people don't respond to them appropriately, with appropriate timing, such as picking them up, that sort of thing, interacting with them physically, then within a few months, they will quit smiling. So the timing of social interaction matters. Most importantly, babies need human interaction. They don't need being set in front of a TV set or video game. Dr. Hood avoids giving parents specific advice because he says normal social interaction is generally sufficient. He does endorse reading to your children from an early age. But don't waste your money on baby Einstein programs and Mozart tapes. Another aspect of our social nature is that we are much more susceptible to trying to please others than we think we are. We talked about a few of the famous experiments that have demonstrated this, and I will have some links for this, especially in the transcript. Unfortunately, we continue to see this tendency play out in real life. For example, the torturing of the Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib, which of course is a great embarrassment to most Americans, is a classic example of this. As I mentioned in the interview, I happened to read The Self-Illusion around the same time I was reading another book called The Storytelling Animal by Jonathan Gottschall. The place where these two books intersect is in their discussions of storytelling in the brain. In the context of today's conversation, it seems significant that children begin to appreciate storytelling around the same age that they begin to exhibit true autobiographical memories, around 3 or 4 years old. Not surprisingly, this is essential to the emergence of the type of self that we think of as truly human. Since it's clear that our brain is constantly fabricating this autobiographical self, it is interesting to speculate that one reason storytelling is universal is that it is an outgrowth of this same process. I interviewed Jonathan Gottschall for the most recent episode of Books and Ideas, so I encourage you to check out that interview to learn more. The two key points from this episode are, first, the feeling that each of us has that we are a single coherent individual is an illusion. Instead, the self is the ongoing creation of multiple competing processes going on in our brain. Most of these processes are inaccessible to our conscious awareness. Since the brain works very hard to present a coherent self, we often can't see the most glaring inconsistencies in our own behavior. Second, human beings are wired to be social. Beginning at birth, and maybe before, we are constantly shaped by our interactions with those around us. Experiments in real life have consistently shown that this influence is stronger than many of us want to believe. It's not easy to go against the group, but if you do, it is possible to influence others in a positive way. So today's book was The Self-Illusion by Bruce Hood, and I highly recommend it for all readers. Now I want to start my closing announcements by mentioning something that I really meant to talk about at the very beginning of the podcast. Some of you longtime listeners may recall that a few years back I talked about the possibility of providing continuing education credits for people who like to listen to the Brain Science podcast. And this was something that never really came to be because I discovered that I didn't really have the resources or time to make this happen on my own. However, recently I have begun licensing episodes of the Brain Science podcast to continuing education providers. So right now there are about 10 or 11 episodes that psychologists can get continuing education credit. In the near future, there will be links up on the website that will tell you which episodes. But in the meantime, if you're interested in getting these continuing education credits and want to know which episodes are available, just drop me an email at docartemis@gmail.com. Also, if you are involved in continuing education and are interested in licensing the Brain Science podcast or know somebody who might be, please let me know. Also, if you're a physician or nurse and have suggestions about how I could get episodes into the hands of people who create continuing education for physicians and nurses, again, just drop me an email. I'm actually hoping that in the long run, this might be a good way to generate some significant income from the podcast, since the podcast and the transcripts remain free. Meanwhile, the Brain Science podcast continues to rely on support from listeners like you. To learn more about how you can help, just go to the website at brainsciencepodcast.com. And be sure to check out the latest episode of Books and Ideas for the interview with Jonathan Gottschall, author of The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. You'll find that at booksandideas.com. As I mentioned at the beginning, I will be attending the 2012 meeting of the American Academy of Family Physicians in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, October 16th through 20th. If you are going to be at the meeting, I'll be mostly attending events sort of related to the emergency medicine special interest group, but I know there are listeners who are physicians, but I don't know if any of you will be attending this meeting. But even if you aren't attending the meeting, but you happen to be in Philadelphia or live in Philadelphia, I'd love to get together. If you're interested in doing this and the timing works for you, just send me an email at docartemis@gmail.com and we can work out the details. Again, the dates I'm going to be there actually are October 16th through 21st, 2012. As many of you already know, my ebook, Are You Sure? The Unconscious Origins of Uncertainty, is now on sale for only $2.99. So please don't forget to pick up a copy of it and put your review on Amazon or at goodreads.com. I'm continuing to send out free PDFs to people who send me their Amazon receipts for those of you who don't want to read it in the Kindle format. The next Brain Science podcast is going to be a discussion of Antonio Damasio's most recent book, Self Comes to Mind. I'm also going to be having an interview with Evan Thompson, the author of Mind in Life, and an interview with Jacques Panksepp about his new book, The Archaeology of Mind. If you want to make sure that you don't miss any episodes of the Brain Science Podcast, since it comes out only about once a month, be sure to sign up for the Brain Science Podcast newsletter. That way you get the show notes automatically every month and you won't miss an episode. If you want to connect with other Brain Science Podcast fans, go to the Brain Science Podcast fan page on Facebook, our discussion forum on Goodreads, or our Google Plus page. You can post comments for any episode in any of these sites. And as always, you can send me feedback at docartemis@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter at docartemis, DocArtemis. Thanks again for listening. I look forward to talking with you again very soon. The Brain Science Podcast is copyright 2012, Virginia Campbell, MD. You can copy this podcast to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at docartemis@gmail.com.